We keep saying in our society that the color of your skin should not make a difference in how you are treated in this or any country, but it happens in this country a lot. We'll focus on medicine in this hour because plenty of figures show disparities in the quality of health care based on skin color. The lighter the skin, the better the quality of care. Our guest this hour examines the trends and suggests changes in her book, Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. Dana Bowen Matthew speaks tonight at Southern Oregon University. She's that rare person with expertise crossing two major professional fields. She is a lawyer and works on medical issues. She teaches health law to law students and to public health students at the University of Virginia now. Co-founder of the Colorado Health Equity Project when she was at the University of Colorado, now is working at a new place called the Charlottesville Medical Legal Partnership. And these are designed to get health care to low-income communities and to get lawyers to the people who face continued obstacles. Dana Bowen Matthew, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Jeffrey, it's a pleasure to be here.
So right off the bat, in reading the book, Just Medicine, ouch. I mean, you're more than 80,000 people die each year because they are members of minorities and their care is lacking.
Yeah, that's the gripping number. And the adjective that's most important is that those deaths are needless. Those are from preventable diseases all across the spectrum at various types of facilities. They could be at clinics, hospitals, public, private, profit, nonprofit. And we see that care varies with race, not only race, also with gender, with sexual orientation, with disability. And those are the kinds of changes that need to be made in order for equity to reign.
Now, if people are thinking, this is an interesting 1-2 punch you provide here, because if people are thinking, well, it's not that they're black, it's that they're poor, but the fact is you actually factored out things like socioeconomic status, didn't you?
That's right. Most of the studies that I looked at, not only my book, but in 2003, the Institute of Medicine, now the National Academies of Medicine, did a comprehensive study of 600 peer-reviewed data-driven studies. And they controlled for, which is the statistician's way of saying we eliminated the socioeconomic status, the income, the wealth, and the differences with insurance status, and still found that we have what I would describe as a race problem in healthcare.
Has your thinking about how that might be addressed and how it might be corrected, has it evolved at any in recent years?
It actually has. I wrote the book thinking that implicit bias, that is unconscious racism, is really the key. That is, everyone is intending to do good, but because of our social knowledge, the music we listen to, the radio stations, dialogues and plays and the things that we're exposed to, we unintentionally discriminate. And certainly that remains true. But I live in Charlottesville, Virginia, and I now believe that there's a closer connection between that and the kind of overt discrimination that we've seen played out on the national stage recently.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I did not realize. I was still thinking you were at the University of Colorado. Here I'm asking about whether you're at the Aurora campus. And you said, no, I'm in Virginia now at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. And you moved in August.
I sure did. In fact, August 11th was scheduled to be my moving day. And my moving truck driver called me and said, guess what? We're not going to Charlottesville on the 11th or on the 12th. And I arrived there later in that week.
So, I mean, what, I mean, you didn't need a wake-up call.
No.
But here you are in the middle of one.
That's true. And I appreciate very much, Jeffrey, that you said I didn't need a wake-up call, because so many in Charlottesville and beyond around the country have been exposed to the type of discrimination that was played out on the national stage in Charlottesville. This discrimination is their lived experience from day to day to day to day to day. And yet, this is a conversation we don't happily and easily have, for good reason. We don't want to talk about the negativity that we hoped was from times gone by. However, now that we see it is not past, now that we see it is still a part of the current lived experience of so many, and in the case of healthcare, is making lives people die sicker and live less healthy lives, we have to do something about it if we want to call ourselves an equitable society.
Has it been hard for you personally, I mean, since arriving in Charlottesville in that set of conditions right after the white supremacist march on August 11th, has your scope gone a little broader than, or have you managed to keep fairly well focused on the healthcare part of things?
Well, I'll say that the healthcare part of things is actually pretty broad. I do public health, and that means I look at population inputs. I want to use a term called the social determinants of health. By that I mean health is affected not just by the healthcare that you get that we've described as inequitable, but it's also affected by the housing that you live in. If you live in substandard housing, then mold, mildew, lead, pest infection, all of that's going to impact
your health.
Living
near a factory.
Living near a factory, exactly. Environmentally, if you live on a Superfund site, if there's lead in your soil, that is going to affect your health. Unfortunately, poor people and black and brown people are disproportionately represented in the neighborhoods where housing, employment, food, and all the social determinants are disproportionately adverse to their health.
Now, granted, this book was written long before the events in Charlottesville, and actually a couple of years before Donald Trump became president, right?
That's right.
Before the rise of so-called white nationalism. And so you rewrite in the book of unconscious racism, but, I mean, is it unconscious, really?
Well, I now believe there's a continuum. There is some unconscious racism, and those of us that are, and I think everyone is, subject to unconscious racism when we are willing just to rest apathetically and believe that, oh, since everybody has it, it can't be so bad, then we make room for, we allow for the continuum to progress to the ugliness that we've seen in Charlottesville. It's my conviction that we all have to act. I, of course, offer legal solutions in the book, but there are policy solutions for institutions and healthcare providers. There are individual solutions for people who are ordinary citizens, but all of us have to activate our preferred egalitarian instincts in order to change what we see in Charlottesville and beyond.
You've already acknowledged this is not a thing we like to talk about in our country, and particularly when you're talking about unconscious racism, if people don't think they're racist, oh, I don't have a racist bone in my body, or they say it about other people, he doesn't have a racist bone in his body, yet by actions, they do.
Well, there's a difference between having no explicit racist bone in their body, and I believe people when they say that. In fact, racism is, contrary to what we think we see right now, pretty much out of style in the United States for the most part. That is explicit racism, overt bigotry, prejudice that is intentional. That is definitely true, and when people say that, they mean it. But what they're not factoring in, Jeffrey, is the fact that all of us have stereotypes. All of us have groupthink about people in groups that we have assumed, based on what we hear and see, negative things about. Here's the catch. When that social knowledge, what we have unconsciously stored, is triggered, it overrides our egalitarian preferences. So I can be a person that doesn't have a racist bone in my body, but I can discriminate.
Back with Dana Bowen Matthew and Just Medicine on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking today about racism, whether it is intentional or not. It does crop up in areas like healthcare. And medicine and skin color has been a focus of Dana Bowen Matthew, a legal expert, for years. She is now at the University of Virginia, also working with the Charlottesville Medical Legal Partnership. She essentially teaches health law to law students and to public health students as well. So she looks at what goes on in medicine and the disparities, the fact that the browner your skin, the worse your health care in America. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I want to let people know, too, this is part of Race Awareness Week that you're being on campus. So you'll be at 7 o'clock tonight at the Stevenson Union Rogue River Room at Southern Oregon University, speaking about just these issues. The result of bias with the separate and unequal health systems that you point out in your book, Just Medicine, has that gotten worse over time, do you think? Is it improving?
Well, there are more areas that are stable and not improving than there are that are improving. But let's talk about the good news just first in order to make sure that people know that it can make a difference when people act on this. So the difference between black and white life expectancy is beginning to narrow. We have seen that over a course of 20 years. And although there are some categories, black men between the ages of 18 and 25, that have not improved, overall, we're seeing that gap narrow ever so slowly. It's still unacceptably large. On the other hand, we are not seeing improvement in infant mortality gaps. This is one of the most troubling, and it's an example of why race matters in health and health quality. Infants who are born to black mothers have two and a half times more likelihood of dying in their first year than those born to white mothers. As you were talking about earlier, when we control for education, when we control for income, even a black mother who is middle class and well-educated is going to lose her child in the United States 2 to 2.5 times more frequently than a white mother.
I want to make it clear, this is multiplied two and a half times, not just 2.5% more.
No. It's multiplied, and in fact, some parts of the country are greater. The sad thing is that in a community where a white mom is uneducated and low income, understand we don't want to lose babies for it. It's a sad thing for no matter what the color of your skin is or what your income is. But we thought we could explain it by income and education. We thought we could say, oh, not enough prenatal care. We thought we could say not access to good food, health care, and so forth. That's why controlling for socioeconomic status should have explained that. The fact that it doesn't means that something pernicious still attaches to race, and we lose those babies who are black and brown more often than we lose the ones that are white.
So we essentially have de facto segregation still in medicine. It sounds like brown people go to brown doctors, white people go to white doctors.
Well, we wish we could have brown people go to more brown doctors. There just happen to be not that many in the medical health workforce. What we do have is segregation throughout the society. So that is reflected in health outcomes. Residential segregation still obtains. When I was coming to Medford, it is stunningly beautiful here. The people are wonderful here. But I think less than 1% of the population is black and less than 2% of the population is Latino. And what that means is we as communities don't touch each other, talk to each other, experience each other's lived experiences. That kind of segregation plays out all over the country. I was born and raised in New York, Northeast City, the most segregated or one of the most residentially segregated cities in America. Now, what does that mean? When you concentrate people racially, you also concentrate them in schools that are racially segregated. You also concentrate them, it turns out, if they're people of color, in neighborhoods that are high poverty. When that's the case, all of their resources, which touch their health, make them a sicker population. Add that to the fact that they have less access to health care. We have the best health care in the country, in the world, that is, in this country. And yet, people who are poor, people who are black and brown, have less access to it. That's how you get the kind of disparity numbers that I'm describing with infant mortality.
Has there been any change since healthcare went mandatory with Obamacare?
Yes, there has been a change. So one of the things that increasing insurance does is it increases the number of people who have the ability to pay for insurance. So we have evidence that as we were able to expand healthcare to 23 million people, that is, we were able to get them insurance coverage. We also found that those people were going to the doctor earlier. They were going to get preventative care. They had people that they could identify as doctors, and we started to see a change in health outcomes as a result. Now, earlier you asked me whether disparities were getting better. Some are. I said life expectancy, but many aren't. We are seeing that the differences between black, white, and Latino deaths from diabetes still pernicious and unacceptably high. The difference between white deaths and Latino deaths and Native American deaths due to heart disease, due to cerebrovascular disease, all of those are remaining stubbornly high.
How much did you control for whether people did seek out medical care? I wonder about that part of it, because if there's something in either family or culture or just what goes on in a particular neighborhood that says, you know, you don't go to a doctor unless this happens, if that entered the picture at all.
Of course it does. Health behavior in always has a very important effect. We have something called the social determinants, as I referred to earlier, and we're able to estimate a divide between health behaviors, genetics, social and environmental factors, and healthcare factors. And without a doubt, approximately 30% of what causes your health to be good or bad, what determines your health, has to do with health behaviors. As you asked, whether you seek out a doctor, whether you prefer to smoke, whether you have a sedentary lifestyle, whether you eat well, all of those things are influenced. But again, here's one of the things I think we don't talk about enough, and that is that health behaviors themselves are influenced by social context. So let's take this question of, do we seek out a doctor? If I seek out a doctor and I have an unpleasant experience because that doctor's communication with me is tinged with what I interpret as bias, what I experienced as perceived discrimination, I am not going to seek out that doctor as often. And so in a very perverse way, I exercise my autonomy against my health interest based on discrimination that I've experienced.
Wow, it really can get in a lot of different ways here. We're talking to Dana Bowen-Matthew about health in America and the differences based on skin color. She's written a book called Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. We have an email here from Wolfgang, and well, he calls it Soggy Valley today, but it is Sunny Valley. He says, a simple question about a simple study that may never have been done because the results would be too disconcerting. Don't white people predominantly have a repulsion from even touching black people? And considering that the medical profession, including nurses, is still predominantly white, and he trails off on a couple of dots.
We don't have a study about touch that I'm aware of. And if you find one, I'd be very interested to see it. We do have a study recently done at the University of Virginia. I have to claim this study and the outcome, looking at whether medical students are sympathetic to the pain that people of color experience. And that study turned up some unfortunate biases. That is, that white providers, in this case medical students in training to become providers, thought ridiculously, quite frankly, that black people might have thicker skin, thicker blood, less likelihood to feel pain, and therefore they were less likely to give them equal treatment in this regard. Another one of the very untrue stereotypes is that black and brown people might divert painkillers more frequently than whites, use drugs and abuse them more than whites. Well, this turns out to be untrue. But now I want to give credit to the University of Virginia. Not only did they publish the study, but they used it, the truth of it, as a way to begin to teach students differently, to engage in a conversation that was frank, transparent, and in fact changing the way healthcare was delivered. I guess if we got that study about touch, we could do the same.
Okay. So this is a medical school thing they've begun to institute at the University of Virginia?
Yes.
That's great. The so before we get into further into specific provider-patient relationships, I want to get into some of the legal history, which is obviously your strong suit, knowing the law so well. You do start with the colonial laws and how people who did not have white skin were treated through history, but then you get quickly into the early 20th century and how laws then made things worse. How?
Sure. I'm not the only scholar doing this work, but there are laws still that are disproportionately enforced against people of color. And those laws have a health impact. So in our early history, those laws were, of course, about treating people as property. They were talking about access to good housing. We had housing and zoning laws that excluded people in segregated communities. We had vagrancy laws that were enforced just to make sure that people lived in ghettos as opposed to disseminated throughout the general population. We still see, however, that the enforcement of anti-discrimination laws is uneven, so that people who suffer very frank and overt racism are not getting the kind of relief that I believe the civil rights law was intended to offer. Recent cases include a kid who was harassed for the color of their skin, including beaten up, called the N-word, treated really in a way that will impact his mental health for life. Our civil rights laws are now being stripped of their power. Our Supreme Court is interpreting them so that they are very limited in their application and pretty much unavailable to kids like the one I've just described.
Well, how recent is that case you cite?
Oh, about less than 5 years old.
Oh, wow. So still happening now.
Yes.
So at one point, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act was used as a lever.
And successfully so. Mm-hmm. I still contend that it's a very important statute to achieve health equity and equity in society generally. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court has interpreted it in a way that I think is inconsistent with the history of the act and the legislative history of what Congress intended. So some of the things that we have to do, quite honestly, are fix the court's interpretation of the Civil Rights Act, such as Title VI.
Which is a long process that involves sending cases to trial and then up to appellate courts and onward.
It is a long process, but we're also beginning to see some interpretation at the administrative level. Very recently, some of the EPA's decisions have, I think, returned to a proper interpretation of Title VI, and now we'd like to see that enforced.
Dana Bowen-Mathieu, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. She is in the law school at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, arrived in Charlottesville in August, we've already established. She'll be speaking tonight at Southern Oregon University at 7 o'clock at the Rogue River Room at the Stevenson Union. You can join our conversation now on the Exchange about inequities in healthcare in America based on skin color. 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The way that facilities have been separate but unequal in so many realms, but in health too, clearly, as you point out in the book. And then there's a case here, Alexander versus Sandoval, which essentially says that segregation is okay if you got there by accident, essentially?
Alexander v. Sandoval is a case I'd like to see reversed. Right now it says that I don't have, as a private citizen, the power to allege, for example, that the hospital that is in my community is discriminating in violation of the civil rights law. As you correctly pointed out, patients of color concentrated in segregated communities go to hospitals where the doctors have less training. Those hospitals have fewer resources in terms of the type of medical equipment. They are clearly receiving inferior care because the facilities, the training, the workforce is less likely to be able to give them high-quality health care. It used to be that Title VI was useful in that type of litigation. Alexander v. Sandoval took the right of individual private citizens away that used to be able to allege these violations to get some redress in court. Now, the way that this court case has taken that right away is by interpreting Title VI very narrowly, interpreting it to say, first of all, only an agency can bring a claim, not a private citizen, but also interpreting it to say that when the claim is brought, the private citizen has to show intentional discrimination. So think about it for a second, Jeffrey. What healthcare provider, what person who's dedicated as a nurse, a physician's assistant, a doctor, gets up in the morning and says, I want to discriminate against people? This is not the profession where people are frank bigots. This is a serving profession where people go to do good. So what we are seeing is that we're asking people to prove something that they are not going to find. You're not going to find a memo that says, I don't want to touch black people. I don't want black people in my hospital. Honestly, as an aside, you will be able to find patients who say they don't want to be touched by black providers. We do have cases of that nature. But we don't find those anymore. So what explains this discriminatory treatment, the inferior health outcomes? What explains it is not intentional discrimination. I think in part what explains it is unintentional discrimination. That's why we need Alexander v. Sandoval changed, so that we can actionably address unintentional discrimination.
So your studies are not just about case law and about legal history by a long shot. You actually went and talked to physicians for the book, and a fair number of them, it sounds like.
I did. I talked to physicians. I talked to dentists. I talked to patients. And I asked them what their experience with implicit bias or unconscious racism was.
So I mean, if it's implicit, they don't even think they're doing it, right?
That's correct. But one of the things that's really important to realize is that we can see the effects of what's being done. We can see these disparate outcomes that we talked about in diabetes, in infant mortality, in life expectancy. We can see that blacks are getting less care in cancers. They're getting diagnosed later. They're getting treated with less intensive treatments, and therefore their longevity and life expectancy after diagnosis is vastly different from whites. We can see the effect, and that should be enough to call us to action, to call us to want to do something about this kind of discrimination.
Is it harder to get medical professionals to even come to grips with the possibility that there's implicit bias because they think in terms of, I'm a scientist, I just follow the procedure?
I think that's true of medical physicians, but it's also true of human beings. We don't like to think of ourselves as bad people. We don't like to think of ourselves as racist. And so getting people to discuss the fact that they might in fact be contributing to discrimination is very difficult. You point out that physicians are objective. They're trained as scientists. They're trained to look at data. One of the reasons I included so much data in my book is because it makes it irrefutable that there is some kind of a problem. Physicians, nurses, all the clinicians that I've ever encountered really do care about patient population and patient health outcome. So once you put the data out there and you see life expectancies are shorter and so forth, then you can get them into the conversation about what might be contributing to that.
Are there studies, and I don't know whether they come from law school, from medical school, from the psychology department, that measure the interactions between patients and providers and notice differences, trends
in
differences?
Yes, there are. Yes, there are. In fact, some of the studies have to do with communication between physicians and their patients. So what we have seen is that there is a correlation. And by correlation, we don't mean causation, but we do mean there's an association where we can see that when physicians have an increased level of bias, as measured by things like the IAT, a very well-validated, though somewhat controversial test, when physicians have increased their bias, they tend to communicate differently with patients based on color. What do I mean by that? They may sit further away from that patient. They may have a shorter conversation and clinical encounter with that patient. The eye contact with the patient of color may be less than the eye contact with the patient who is white. How do we know this? Well, some of the researchers, Lisa Cooper comes to mind at Johns Hopkins, have videotaped actual clinical encounters, have audiotaped those conversations, and then gone back and coded them. How long were they? Where were people sitting? How many questions were asked? How much information was volunteered? And we do see a difference by race.
Okay, much more to explore here, obviously, with Dana Bowen-Matthew. Her book is called Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. You can join the conversation here on The Exchange by phone or by email. You can also catch Dana in action live tonight. She's part of Race Awareness Week at Southern Oregon University, talking about the very things we're talking about here, lessons from Charlottesville and Flint. That'll be tonight at 7 at the Rogue River Room at the Stevenson Union at Southern Oregon University. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more with Dana in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Dana Bowen-Matthew from the University of Virginia. She works in the law school teaching health law to law students and to public health students as well. She is the founder, or co-founder rather, of the Colorado Health Equity Project and is starting a similar effort in Charlottesville, the Charlottesville Medical Legal Partnership, or Common Grounds. We're still working on the name there. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we talk about the topics raised in her book, Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. And she'll be talking about healthcare bias tonight, lessons from Charlottesville and Flint, on the Southern Oregon University campus at 7 p.m. Join us now at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we've been talking about direct provider-patient interactions, and I want to hear you talk about Kevin Shulman's study. He used actors playing people with symptoms.
Oh, sure. That was one of the watershed studies, Jeffrey. Kevin Shulman did a experiment in which 8 actors were different only by the way that they looked, black or white, and their gender, male or female. They were all dressed alike, and they read from the same script in order to describe their infirmity, which in that case was cardiovascular disease. After the physicians in the study looked at that videotape vignette, they were then asked to prescribe a treatment. And what Shulman's study back in 1999 found was that there was an association between race, gender, and the quality of the treatment decision. So you would see that the odds of getting the best treatment were higher if you were white and male, and the odds of getting the worse or less effective treatment were lower if you were female and black. So that started the ball rolling, because then the inquiry became why? What would explain that? Well, there are a lot of things that could explain it, but the things that I'm working on have to do with race discrimination. So then later, after Shulman's study, other researchers asked physicians to first take a test about the level of their implicit bias, and then do much the same thing, different diseases, different settings, but then much the same thing. You see how repeating that kind of an experiment could look and see, well, why is that correlation? Does it have anything to do with implicit bias? In many instances, there was a positive, that means a consistent relationship between higher levels of implicit bias, as measured by the IAT, and higher discrimination levels, pro-white, anti-black, pro-Latino, pro-Latino, pro-white, anti-black, pro-white, anti-Latino, right, in many, many studies. Not all, though. So what we generally saw was that as physicians' implicit bias increased, so did the likelihood that they would give the best treatment decisions to whites and the less effective treatments to blacks.
So I, with all the data that is available, and it's not just coming from people like yourself who work in law schools, but it's coming from people across the spectrum of things in the health industry itself, does medicine still resist the change, thinking the problem's not that big, or are medical schools really taking, like what you talked about at the University of Virginia, where they're really taking it to heart?
I feel as though we're starting to see a change in attitude. I had the pleasure of talking at the American Association of Medical Colleges this past weekend. I had hundreds of people in the room sitting and talking together about ways to address implicit bias and discrimination in the healthcare setting. I know this is being replicated around the country because people are tweeting about it, talking about it. One of the most important things that we have to do, though, is realize that implicit bias and even explicit discrimination come from complex places. And even if we were to make everybody an egalitarian at one time inside of the healthcare system, we still have a lot of discrimination to deal with. That affects health outside of the healthcare system. So we have a big, complicated problem, but I do see, in direct answer to your question, I do see providers beginning to pay attention.
So even if you wiped out all the implicit bias in the doctor-patient relationship today, you'd still have to deal with the effects of discrimination outside.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's no question. That's what it means to deal with the social determinants of health, right? If I'm discriminated against in my workplace, here's an example that we're dealing with quite a lot today. People who are foreign-born, whether or not they're in status or out status in the United States, that is, whether or not they have a current legal document that permits them to be here, they are feeling an increase in the stress associated with discrimination against people who are foreign born. That has a health impact. It's associated with anxiety, depression, and other physical ailments that those people are experiencing before they enter the clinical setting, before they enter the doctor's lounge.
So life is different already, just walking in the door.
And life is different in ways that impacts health.
Let us take a call here. Jake in Springfield, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dana Bowen Matthew.
Hi. Thank you for your guests and her insights. I wanted to just point out that perhaps access to medical care can be dangerous. And I point to the current epidemic of opioids. It's predominantly affecting a white population, you know, mostly in maybe New Hampshire, Kentucky, West Virginia, and Ohio. And I assume, and you can compare it to the crack epidemic of the 80s and the 90s, which predominantly affected blacks. But I see that the current epidemic, which is, if you add up the number of casualties in the past year, it exceeds 20 years of deaths from the Vietnam War. I mean, it's way more potent than even the war on terrorism today. You know, mm-hmm. And it predominantly affects young white people. And for the first time, you know, the life expectancy for white males and for white females is going down, partly due to this opioid epidemic. And a lot of it is fueled by physician prescriptions. Perhaps physicians trust their white patients more and they give them larger prescriptions. And unfortunately, it makes them addicted and hooked. And maybe they might not be that, you know, may be more paternalistic for black patients or Hispanic patients, give them less. Hmm. But the opioid epidemic is striking the white community in tragic ways that's, you know, that rivals AIDS, you know, at the height.
All right, let's take this up with Dana. Thanks for the call, Jake. Appreciate that.
Jake, you're absolutely right. This caller is absolutely right in looking at the opioid epidemic and crisis, quite frankly, as an example of how medicine can hurt, how access to medical care can hurt. I want to broaden the things that have contributed to this terrible, terrible scourge, however. And the reason I broaden them is because your caller was wise to compare the opioid epidemic that we're experiencing right now to the epidemic in the 80s that predominantly affected inner city youth and individuals. We called it the crack epidemic, but there was also another heroin epidemic during the 70s that affected inner city, predominantly black and brown populations. So we've seen opioid as an epidemic before. It is not only prescribing practices that is causing this epidemic to spin out of control. It is one of the factors. But we should look at the economies of the places that are suffering, where whites are dying so rapidly. It is New Hampshire, Maine, Pennsylvania, Ohio. These are places where the economies have gone into decline. So what I am beginning to suggest is that when people are poor, they look for ways to make themselves feel better. White people do that, and Black people do that. Brown people do that, and all people do that. It's not based on the color of your skin that when you are discouraged because employment has left your city, when your families fall apart because of the economic deprivation in your town, when you can't get a job, you can't get an education, and you can't secure your future, people behave in ways that are self-destructive. The reason I bring this up is because I would like us to stop thinking about solutions that address only Blacks or whites, but to think about solutions and use the opioid epidemic as an example, but to think about solutions that could extend treatment to all. We did not treat the first opioid epidemic during the 60s as a public health problem like we should have. We treated it like a criminal justice problem. And we sent people to jail.
Stiffened a lot of laws.
We stiffened a lot of laws, and we sent a lot of people to jail. We need to unravel that. Where people were afflicted the way whites are being afflicted now, but they were Black and sent to jail, we should enlighten the kinds of sentences. We should reverse the access to treatment, and we should take people now out of jail for the diseases that put them there and treat all people for this terrible substance use disorder.
Let us get another call in here from, not that one. Let's go to Ben in Junction City. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dana Bowen Matthew.
Hi, I was wondering if you could comment about the recent studies and reports I've heard about, maybe actually even on this program, about African Americans not being willing to participate in medical research, that they have a great fear of past studies being used against them, from medical studies at universities and colleges, and that they're affiliated with the government.
All right. Fair question. Thanks for that, Ben. Appreciate it.
Ben, that's a really good question, not only because it is true empirically, but also it has a long-term effect. If Blacks, women, others who have are not white and male are not represented in research trials, are not represented in the drug development, then their treatment is going to be ignored or inferior. So a disproportionate number of people who are Black are not showing up in research trials, and some of it is because of a memory. Some of it is because of the Tuskegee experiment. We remember being misused and have a distrust that still remains today as research subjects. That kind of mistrust it continues to be validated. Henrietta Lacks is a more recent example of someone being misused who was Black. Family recently settled, some say inequitably, but they did settle the case involving research use of her genes and her body products, not sharing the wealth of research with people who are participating in those services can reduce the number of people who are Black and brown and participating in research trials. So it's incumbent upon our research infrastructure to reach out, to change our consent mechanism so that we're able to build trust, so that we're able to be inclusive, so that our science is actually reliable and valid as opposed to biased and invalid. It is still a really important area that there needs to be more work and change in.
Let's talk about large-scale public health things in a different zone here. We're talking about Flint and the whole water situation in Flint, Michigan, where the general perception is that it was allowed to go on unchecked for a long time, where lead was getting into people's bodies because of the fact that it was a largely Black city and nobody particularly cared.
Yeah, sadly, it's not the only city that has that problem. So I had the privilege of working with Senator Debbie Stabenow in Michigan during the Flint crisis. I was able to see up close and personal not only her commitment to her constituency, but the way that several others, frankly, in the United States Senate, although they have not prevailed, because frankly, Flint is still in a unacceptably terrible condition without water access. But what we see there is not just that the water was inaccessible, but Flint was 47% of its population was below the poverty line. 56% of its population was African American. Those two things combined left that city powerless. The schools are predominantly segregated. There was not in at the time that the Flint water crisis was declared, there was not a single chain supermarket in the city of Flint. That means their access to fresh food and fresh vegetable was seriously restricted.
Not a single national chain supermarket.
So people there got their food from convenience stores, small local stores that didn't provide the kind of healthy produce that people need to be healthy. And it went on. Schools were segregated so that of the 15 public schools that were in Flint, fully 8 of them had 80% or more of their population of one racial group or another versus another. Not integrated schools, not equally resourced. It went on so that housing stock was inferior in Flint. And what we see is that a broad discrimination against a people who were left politically powerless. Remember, Flint was not a democracy. They had their democratically elected leaders stripped away, replaced with managers who had an agenda
from
that they didn't elect.
Because the city was bankrupt?
That's right. Mm-hmm. All of these are examples of discrimination, some explicit and some, quite frankly, explicit. But they all converge together to adversely affect the health, mental health and physical health of children in Flint for their entire lives.
Because lead poisoning is not reversible anymore.
It's not reversible.
Just hearing that again the other day.
That's not reversible.
The book will anger you, blow your socks off, and ultimately perhaps resolve you to take some action. You can see Dana Bowen Matthew tonight at 7 o'clock at the Stevenson Union Rogue River Room on the Southern Oregon University campus, talking about healthcare bias, lessons from Charlottesville and Flint. Her book is called Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. Thank you so much for stopping by the Exchange today. Really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
All right, take care.